Welcome to the Women, Peace and Rights podcast hosted by the Women's Regional Network. WRN amplifies the voices of conflict-affected women in order to address the interlinked issues of peace and justice, governance and security. Network members have come from Afghanistan, Pakistan, India and Sri Lanka, as well as East Africa. I'm Swadna, WRN founding member, and I am delighted today to welcome our guest, Professor Betty Reardon. Professor Betty Reardon, who actually needs no introduction, is a pioneering feminist peace educator and activist who has worked to introduce a gender perspective into peace education as it is practiced in formal and non-formal learning settings. She is the founder of the Peace Education Program at Teachers College, Columbia University, which was founded in 1983, the International Institute on Peace Education, IIPE, founded in 1982, and the Global Campaign for Peace Education, GCPE, founded in 1999. Professor Reardon's pioneering work in peace education and human rights has laid the foundation for a new cross-disciplinary integration of peace education and international human rights from a gender global perspective. One of the first to make clear the connection between sexism, patriarchy and militarism, she has held the gender equality and justice as a prerequisite of peace and women's participation and agency a precondition of any sustainable peace. It's really always a privilege to speak with you, Betty, and I cannot but start with 1325, the process of getting to which you were a very integral part of. So in the 20 years since the adoption of 1325, what have been the most tangible successes and what are the most regrettable failures on our part, in your view?
Well, first, let me say it's wonderful to talk to you and see you and to engage in this ongoing conversation, because it seems that we're deeply integrated into learning together about how gender impacts on issues of human security, war and peace. As anyone who knows my work knows, I consider 1325 to be really a major landmark in all of the standards that have been set by the United Nations. And I think we have to understand 1325 from its roots rather than only from how it is purveyed. People become acquainted with 1325 as the United Nations Security Council resolution on women, peace, and security, and think of it in terms of an institutional declaration or regulation, when in fact it is a statement. Granted, it is in the language of the institution, but it was a statement of goals, worldview, and purposes of the women who saw it as a necessity. And they saw it as a necessity of a way of getting into the system that seemed to be one of the dominant actors in war and peace. So when I think of what the major successes are, I think of that process, civil society women being the initial energy. And I also think of how that process has continued as civil society, women's groups associated with the UN, and subsequently women's groups on the ground, taking 1325 as a guideline for their own actions in their own situations, so that the most significant successes of 1325 have in local and regional settings where the standard has been used to empower women to decrease violence and become participants in security issues in their own societies. Just to be brief about the response, in terms of the shortcomings, I think the shortcomings have been too many of the activists as well as the members of the institutions, that is, the people in the UN agencies, the delegations and so forth, have concentrated on the nation state as the actor of implementation. And that was very problematic from the beginning, but was seen as the way to implement 1325 was to get national plans of action. but I can tell you that most of them have not been very effective in actual implementation. The implementation is coming from the ground, and the national plans are and can be used in the same way the resolution itself was, as the political rationale on which to act and having been granted the right to act. So most of this, in terms of what is going on, has happened, and will happen in the future, is going to come from the ground. And that's why it's very important for women to realize that they do have agency and they have power when they exercise it. Power, like any muscle, gets stronger as you use it.
In fact, as you were talking about the use of the NAPs in the same way as 1325 as an advocacy tool, I was remembering that many of the petitions and letters that have circulated in the last 6 months around the US withdrawal from Afghanistan have actually pointed to the existence of a US NAP, I think in the WPS Act that was passed a couple of years ago. And so, yes, absolutely, that's an illustration of exactly what you said. So, talking about Afghanistan, in what way do recent events there reflect these shortcomings or the effectiveness? Where has 1325 worked, and having an NAP, worked for Afghanistan, and where has it not?
Well, it has in this sense. 1325 was originally cited by those of us in starting out in the United States, but reaching out to collaborators around the world, when we realized what the consequences to women were going to be on the very rapid withdrawal of US and NATO troops from Afghanistan. And on the basis, we appealed to the president and ultimately to US ambassador to the UN and to take action to protect women on the basis of 1325, which obligates member states to protect women in armed conflict. We used that as the rationale. It became verbalized as a rationale. And although 1325 was mentioned by the media, it was once or twice mentioned in the Security Council. It was not the rationale for any of the supposed policies about Afghanistan. And since August 15th, in efforts to somewhat control, somewhat modify the dialogue with the Taliban, it hasn't been mentioned because it is anathema to the Taliban, could trigger some effects that we wouldn't want. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that here is another phase, how to deal with 1325, that we need to understand and be familiar with what it calls for, and ask for it in ways and in language that are not trigger points. So I think 1325 has been helpful in the sense of our knowing the obligation is there, but it hasn't really fully been, in my opinion, other people will have other opinions. In my opinion, we have not been able to use it as, or the system has not used it as an effective instrument. And it's one reason, I think, why there has been no significant intervention to protect women. There's a lot of verbiage, a great deal of verbiage, but there's been no practical action, no specification of sanction, little warnings, but nothing actionable.
Would you say that what we're witnessing in terms of the non-effectiveness of 1325, or the absence of 1325 from the discourse, serious absence, is actually a symptom of what some others are calling a pushback on the WPS agenda itself, with the resolutions that sought to dilute the sexual and reproductive health protections, you know, watering down the commitment to, even the token commitment to WPS in order to appease the Taliban. Do you read this as part of a larger pushback?
No, I don't. I don't. I do see there's definitely, and I don't even think it's a pushback, because the main actors that are pushing forward repression of women, denial of reproductive rights, are the same actors who are repressing democracy in other ways. And, you know, we have a little petri dish in Texas where there is an experiment with authoritarianism. fundamentalist religious authoritarianism, which is very familiar to anybody who is familiar with the conditions in Afghanistan. But that is, I think that's apart from 1325, because most of these people don't even know 1325 exists. I think the failure is not of 1325. I think it is the failure of the system to use 1325 and to work out a way of using it, not just to say we can't use it because that's a red flag. But it's like every challenge, systemic challenge, you have to find a way to operate within the system that doesn't set the system off balance if you're not ready for that to take place. If you're ready to topple the system and you got an alternative, okay, go with it. But if you don't, you need to work in the system and around the system. But that means you have to think of alternatives. And that's not the way most of the people in power think. They don't think in multiple alternatives. They think transactionally.
It's a really important distinction, I think, to keep in mind. And that brings me to my next question, which actually comes out of an exchange you and I have had in the last few months, where I felt desperate and helpless, and what can we do and what difference does it make? And you said to me, and I love these words, the operative pronoun is we. And so to others who listen to this and who feel like I do, I think particularly with regard to international affairs, because you feel that you're this one small citizen in some distant part of the world, and your voice is too faint for the world to hear. So where would you suggest that people start as peace builders?
Well, I think one of the ways to start is with that word. Despair and powerlessness are felt by one. I feel powerless. I am despairing. You cannot say that for others unless you are in some sort of support group where you're all dealing with your despair or something. But to understand that although we experience this very subjectively, and certainly that has been my experience through working with Afghanistan, where the people in peril are people who I have come to know. I know their names, I know their profiles, I know their circumstances, and their situation is painful to me. And it is leading to, from time to time, outrage at power structures who could liberate them, who are not taking steps to do that. So that means all of that falls to us. I am not powerful except to change myself, which is helpful. But once I have collaborative relationships with others who have the same concerns, then I have the possibility to act beyond myself. I have the possibility also to think with them, what is it that we despair of? Why do we despair? What are the circumstances that are creating this despair? What in those circumstances do we have an opportunity to intervene in? Where can we act, even if it's only in our own kitchens? That's not such a bad example. In the United States, we could look at our kitchens and what we have in our kitchens and what we buy and what we use in terms of how that affects other people's lives. You know, and that is one way to begin to become, and looking at those connections and how the circumstance that we might be able to intervene in could link to another circumstance. And then the question is, how do we of our we reach out to other we's? How do you start to make those interconnections? How do you keep them alive in a situation of repression and threat? These are all issues that we actually face, but we can deal with them, we face them, but we have to see them. We have to look beyond ourselves and our own feelings to where the feelings come from. You know, I am part of a very small network that is working on protection of Afghan women, and we have had very few successes, but we learn and we continue to learn and we find other possibilities, and we haven't run out of possibilities yet. I firmly believe as long as we keep looking, we will find possibilities.
Thank you. for saying that. I actually wanted that on record. I wanted people to be able to go back to hear this, because this is something that we need to remind each other and remind ourselves of over and over when we get up in the morning. And yeah, on the mornings that, you know, the first thing you do is you read the news and it wants you to shut down.
Tell you, I take my morning coffee very often from a mug on which is emblazoned my friend Peter Weiss's favorite saying, despair is not an option.
I need to get a copy of your mug and have my morning tea with it. Although I rarely despair that much myself. But this month, August, September, these 2 months have been, you know, well, last year, the year that we lost to the pandemic was a year of many happy landmarks and milestones, Beijing and 1325, and, you know, name them. It was like every 3 months we were due to celebrate something. This has been the opposite kind of August, September, because we watched the humanitarian crisis. We watched it coming and we couldn't stop it. And then we watched it unfold. And then the anniversary of 9/11. And I'm thinking, as parents, as aunts and uncles, as teachers, I know that these are teachable moments, but where do you start that conversation in a world that's so full of fiction and fact all mixed up together, outrage masters opinion? How do you grab that teachable moment? Well, how do you have the conversation we want?
I think the conversation, whether it's with children in a schoolroom or friends around the table, has to begin finding some common frames of reference, and also has to start with understanding how all of the participants are entering the frame of reference. And in the case of classroom, it's very important for a teacher to understand that. There are some very simple kinds of ways, always with questions, but to raise the question, has your family been discussing what has happened in Afghanistan? Have you seen something on TV about Afghanistan? What do you know about it? How do you feel about it? And so you begin to build a common ground, information, and responses to the information. Then you go into the, you know, at a higher level, we would call analysis. But you could say, and why do you think this happened? Do you think something else could have been done? Do you think something can be done now to help? And who are the people who could do those things? Are there any things that you yourself could do? So that what you want, I think, to do is to open a vision of a situation in a systemic context for the question who should be acting. The responses are probably going to be multiple. So as you put those together, you can simply illuminate a system and say, okay, here are the places where something could be done, and maybe we could encourage some of these people or do something ourselves, so that you begin to get them to think about how they might have political efficacy and how they might have specific civic efficacy in and of themselves in their own groups. But it's always with questions and seldom, if ever, making statements, encouraging reflection on values by the questions you ask. But always, you know, I have always talked in teaching about the front burner and the back burner. And the front burner is what's coming out of the teacher's mouth, largely in response to what the students are saying. And what's on the back burner are a specific strategy and plan and a learning goal. And negotiating the space between the front burner and the back burner is what we call teaching.
Lovely. I'm going to take that into class prep tomorrow. You know, it's one of the great privileges of the present moment of my life that I get to work with you. And it's always a privilege to talk with you and to learn from you, always an education. So I want to thank you for your time and generosity in doing this podcast interview for WRN. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Swarna, and thank you for the questions that helped me to learn, because I always learn in these conversations, as I always learned in every classroom session. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Women, Peace and Rights podcast. We look forward to your comments and feedback. Please visit our website, womensregionalnetwork.org, and connect with us through Twitter at WRN News. Thank you very much.